Hello and what is up, everybody? Welcome to a new episode of the Wind Up Podcast. It is the July question and answer episode. We are diving into some of the questions that we've received from you, from folks out in the cellar as we've been hosting tastings over the last month. All kinds of good stuff to cover in this episode. My name is Mike. I am the owner and winemaker of MTGA Wines, and I'll be here to guide you through this episode. I know many of you know that already, but if you're new to the show, welcome. It's good to have you. For those that are listening again and again and again and been downloading and listening regularly, welcome back. It is good to have you. Before we get into this week's episode, a few quick announcements as always. Number one, be for sure. All right, time for another cup of coffee, I guess. Be sure to like, share, subscribe to the podcast wherever you're consuming podcasts. You can also view the video portion of this on YouTube, along with all kinds of tasting notes, cellar updates, all kinds of good stuff on our YouTube channel. You can also check us out on any of our social networks at MTGA Wines. We are certainly most active on YouTube and Instagram. You can also find us on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter from time to time. Be sure to check us out at mtgawines.com. Actually, if you want to submit any questions for future Q&A episodes, you can head to that homepage, scroll down towards the bottom. We have a little dialogue box that you can fill out, submit. And then we will receive that question and try and feature it here on the show. Be sure to also slide into our DMs if you think that is going to be a more convenient. These episodes are always a ton of fun to kind of dive into just the wine industry and kind of where you all are at with it and the questions that you have and kind of the quirks that we deal with on a regular basis here. And hopefully this helps dispel some of those things, and hopefully you find some remotely interesting, helpful, informative, yada yada yada, all of the things. We are going to cover a little bit of wine production stuff today. We're going to cover some kind of like retail shop kind of stuff, and also just some like big picture like Napa Valley stuff today. We got a few questions to dive into. As usual, you can see the questions and the timestamps for each in the description of the show. So if you want to fast forward to anything in particular that you find interesting, please feel free to do so. All right. Without further ado, you will hear me click clack in here on the keyboard ever so slightly as I timestamp these, so I don't have to go back and listen to the sound of my own voice through the course of the episode. I can tell you that's still something that is super weird, but here we are. Question number one. We have been talking a lot about this particular topic over the last couple of weeks, and we will continue to do so actually in an upcoming episode. But here we are. During a blending session, if something isn't working or if you're not happy with a wine, what can a winemaker do? Well, if you're truly unhappy with the direction a wine is headed, you have to kind of remember a few things. Number one, you have to kind of remember the historical record and kind of what you're trying to achieve. If you're tasting a blend kind of in a silo away from prior vintages and you don't have a reference point, that can cause a lot of problems. So I think this is what the overwhelming majority of winemakers do. I do not believe any of us work in a vacuum such as this. You know, we were constantly kind of double checking our work by tasting wines we've already made. So if you've watched our blending session episode from a couple weeks back, we talked a lot about, you know, our red blend, the prior year, the 2021 vintage that's already in bottle, it's a finished wine. And we also talked about the 2022 that we were creating that day. And there were certain things that were like, it just doesn't work. Maybe more Cabernet is good. Nope, that didn't work. Maybe more Cabernet Franc's good. Nope, that didn't really work. So it is just kind of like trial and error. And if you find something that you don't like, you do have to go back to the drawing board a little bit. You have to try and figure out, okay, what is it about this wine that I don't like? This is where we get really, really into the minutia of wine tasting, of how a wine tastes and how it feels. Is it a little too bitter? Is it more red fruit driven? We want it to be a little darker or a little richer. Do we want the oak profile to be a little bit more intense and more toasty? Or do we want to dial that back and not have as much new oak influencing that wine. So if you're not happy with where a wine is going, you can make those little tweaks. And if you've been tasting these wines regularly, like you should be as a winemaker, you know where these lots are. You know where these barrels are at, and you can say, all right, let's say a wine's a little too oaky and you don't like it. You're like, well, we have these few barrels that are in brand new oak. Let's go ahead and back that off a little bit. We don't want to use all of that new oak in this wine. And let's use stuff that's been in barrels that's been, you know, once used, or maybe they're neutral. They're not giving a lot of that oaky, woody kind of characteristic. And you can back it off. Maybe a wine just isn't big enough, not bold enough. In fact, that was actually our 2022 Cabernet. We'll talk a lot about that in an upcoming episode about the 2022 vintage in general, because it was such a tough blending session. So keep an eye out for that episode to drop in the coming weeks. It needed a little more oomph. So it's like, you know what? We have this Cabernet Franc that's like super intense. It's super tannic. It's got this nice backbone to it. Let's go ahead and use that as a blender for our Cabernet to give it just some broader shoulders. So there's a lot of little things that we can do when it comes to, you know, a blending session and how we're putting together a wine. The limiting factor that we have anytime we're blending is just the volume of wine we have. For example, I mentioned that Cabernet Franc. We have one barrel of it to use for blending, 60 gallons, right? So if we have 60 gallons of Cabernet Franc and we need, let's say we need at least 40 of that for, you know, our red blend. And we have 20 gallons left over. You're like, all right, cool. That's great. We got 20 gallons that can be like our, you know, our wiggle room. And now let's say you have a blend of Cabernet that's 300 gallons. Okay. You're like, all right, we got these 300 gallons of Cabernets, but what we want to do is, in essence, a like 10% addition to this. We need that Cab Franc to bolster it. 10%'s the number. Shoot, we don't have 30 gallons of Cab Franc laying around. We just don't have it. We can either sacrifice the red blend and make that wine worse, or we can make a more like subpar Cabernet. Shoot, what do we do? And this is something that we actually ran into, is because we had such a limited amount of Cab Franc, and we always do because there's so little of it just available and it's super expensive to buy, that we're like, well, we can't use that much Cab Franc in our Cabernet Sauvignon because we simply don't have the volume. We just don't have the volume to be able to create that much, you know, or put that much Franc into this blend. So we're like, okay, we actually have a little bit of Merlot laying around. Let's see if we can't, you know, commandeer a little bit of that. Maybe like the more structured, like the heavier press lot of Merlot. That's a little edgier. It's a little bit more bitter. Still has this nice plush fruit characteristic, but it's got a little bit of it's a little feisty. Let's see if we can blend a percent or two of that in and see if that does the trick. And luckily for us, that's kind of what worked, basically. But it you just have to like do this trial and error. So there's a lot of things you can do when it comes to finalizing a blend. And typically it just means you're tasting, you're retasting, you're checking your work, you're tasting the prior vintages that you've made. And you're like, okay, this is a good continuation of the wines. This is what people expect of this wine. And now we are happy with it. We can bottle it up. I think it is very, very rare, very, very rare that wineries come to the conclusion that they're just unhappy with a wine and they're not going to bottle it. Sometimes that does happen, where it's almost like declaring the vintage for like port or champagne, right? Where it's like, hey, this year is amazing. This is going to be a vintage. We're not going to blend it with other vintages. This is going to be, hey, we're just bottling this, you know, 2022 up on its own. You can have people, you know, within kind of the higher end, like kind of culty wine scene, who, you know, have their second labels. I mean, you know, Screaming Eagle has Second Flight. We always joke, it's like they really need to start another label that's not Screaming Eagle, but they should call it like Cooing Dove, like do the opposite, you know. They haven't done that. That's a terrible marketing idea, but I find it funny. Anyway, you know, maybe we just, point being, maybe we push more of this wine into the second label because it's just not good enough to be a part of the main blend. That's what plenty of wineries do. Or they sell that wine as bulk juice to the highest bidder. They probably take a loss on it and they just go from there. Sometimes you make less wine because a blend just doesn't really come together. We've done that in past years. That's kind of where our red blend program, you know, is bolstered, is because there are certain things from our Cabernet and even our Merlot program that just don't fit into either of those. So we end up using them for this, you know, great amalgamation of different wines in our repechage. So, you know, sometimes there is kind of this catch-all that wineries will use during blending, where they can make sure that no wine goes to waste, or at least very little wine goes to waste. Hopefully that kind of answers your question. Blending sessions are, they can be really, really tough. The 2022s that we've been blending over the last month have been an absolute chore to put together. Definitely keep an eye on that episode. And if you haven't watched it, go back and check out our blending episode from earlier in July as well, to kind of get into the mind of a winemaker and what we actually go through when we're trying to put a wine together. All right, we are going right into question number two. All right, a couple of questions in regards to shopping for wine from some folks that were out at the winery over the last weekend. When shopping for a wine, how can you tell a wine is a quality product and not something that's heavily processed or cheaply made? That's, man, if I had an answer for that, I'd probably be rich. Yeah, because some folks... this is like a tough one to answer, because some folks will rely on something like a Vivino, or maybe it was Delectable, or a Cellar Tracker, or some sort of like crowdsourced, you know, rating system. I felt a little bad. I didn't have it out with somebody, but I was like, even those, like, I'll be honest, like, I don't pay attention to any ratings or reviews. I know some people do. I kind of view it as like social media. When you're posting stuff, it's probably best just to like post and walk away. And if people comment and there's something you need to address, then you address it at that time. But the reality is, you probably shouldn't be refreshing the page every couple of minutes hoping you're getting more likes, you know? So probably just let it lie. What was my point in going through that? Oh yeah. Personal recommendations through like Vivino or like crowdsourced recommendations. But those are great and they can help guide you, but they don't necessarily tell you anything about the wine and how it was made, unless someone has like really intimate knowledge, about that producer. Typically I'll try to find, and this is something if you're really wanting to get into this and sort out like what wines are quality versus not, it really helps to know the winemaker who's at that property. Because if they've worked for, even then, you don't necessarily know their methodology, but it helps. If you know the winemaker and you like what they've done in the past, or you like that wine in particular, then that's kind of like another great way to, you know, bolster or kind of like support that recommendation, or like look at something on a shelf and be like, oh, I know that person because they may also make this wine and I like that wine, so maybe I'll like this one too. It's not going to guarantee that it's cheaply made or heavily processed, but at least there's a good chance you're going to like it. When shopping for a wine in like a retail shop, there are certain things that I just kind of try to avoid. Now I'm obviously a bit of a wine geek. So, you know, when I'm shopping for wine, I've got like my phone out. I'm like looking at the website. I'm trying to dial in as much detail as I can. Especially if I'm buying a wine that I've never heard of or something that I just haven't had in a while, I want to know as much about it as I can. So it's a pain in the ass, but realistically, if you're worried about this, then this is kind of what you need to be doing, because most producers, you're not going to be able to find this on the label necessarily, with a couple of caveats. One is that sometimes there is enough space on a label where wineries will get into kind of their production methods, where their grapes are from, how they were farmed, and they get into like really finite, like granular detail. If you see that, for me personally, that tends to be a good sign, because they're willingly sharing this information with you that they don't have to, and that most wineries don't. If I see the phrase on a back label that we source our grapes from the most premier vineyards in Northern California, that is a huge red flag. already you're being super, super ambiguous about where your grapes are coming from. You're not telling me anything about them, actually. Northern California, as it turns out, is a pretty fucking big place. So if you're not going to be specific about what you're making and it seems intentionally vague, and even on the website, if that kind of continues and I can't dial into any kind of detail about like what exactly, like give me where your vineyards are actually located. Tell me a little bit about how these wines were made. If it's intentionally vague and they kind of focus on just like flavors and characteristics and tasting notes, that red flag is not just a red flag, it is on fire. I'd probably avoid that wine like the plague, because I kind of take the opinion of if they're not willingly sharing production and kind of methodology with you, it's not that they're necessarily wanting to hide stuff, but they probably don't want you to know. And that is kind of a problem. There are obviously exceptions to that. I mean, the way wine is marketed on labels and in shelves or on shelves and retail shops is very old school. It's very archaic. And there are just certain things that people do because that's how things have been done for decades and decades and decades. You very rarely see folks like us that put like a QR code on the back of the label that goes to a website that says, hey, here is how we made our wine, in essence, step by step, minus like hourly timestamps of like how things actually progressed. It's my hope, and for those of you that have heard me stand on this soapbox previously, that wineries will be more transparent and provide this information to you. That way you know whether or not you're buying a truly like craft, like quality wine versus something that is just made in the lab. You know, it's the, and I use this analogy all the time, so forgive me for repeating myself over and over, but it is the difference between supporting that like mom and pop burger joint, right? And then going to McDonald's. Like, hey, I love a Big Mac and those fries are damn delicious, but realistically, I would rather support my local eatery and not this giant fast food chain. Number one, I typically like feel better after I eat it. Like, no hate on McDonald's. I love a Big Mac, like I said. Like, at a very young age, was in training to eat a Big Mac by myself. That is a true story. So, like, no hate, but let's call it what it is. When you're eating something that's mass-produced, heavily processed, there's probably going to be a decent chance that it is not as good for you as buying something from your local farmer's market or like a mom and pop shop type place. That's not always the case, but it can be kind of a good rule to follow. So the more transparency, the better. If you see places or labels and websites and things being intentionally vague, that's kind of a problem. If you're using an app like Vivino, Delectable, if you're relying on ratings and reviews, I'm not that guy. I probably can't give you any good advice because I avoid those personally like the plague because they're not objective. They don't really mean anything. And some person across the world who rated a wine a 2 because they didn't like it, that's not indicative of whether or not you're going to like it. It's just not. It's the same thing that happens when a wine gets 100 points versus like 89 points. You know, we've seen wines in this valley that, you know, are rated very, very highly by one reviewer, and that same vintage, that same wine is rated relatively low by another reviewer. So there's no consistency. It's not objective. And it doesn't tell you actually anything about the quality of that wine and how it was processed. So long story longer, when you're shopping for a wine, look for wines that you know that you trust the people, there's some sort of connection there. It's easy to access information and learn more about that wine and how it was actually made. Those are probably my best tips for finding quality wine out in the wild. It takes more work, it's a pain in the ass, and hopefully more wineries are making it easier for you to access that information in the future, because it's something that frankly needs to be done. Absolutely needs to be done. All right, question number 3. We're just rolling right through these today. Another great question as far as like shopping for wine out and about. Why is it that we can find some wines in a wine shop or a place like Costco for cheaper than we can get them at the winery? This is an issue that happens all the time. Now, to give you a little background, when a wine goes into distribution, whether we're selling like a winery like ourselves is selling directly to a retail shop or a restaurant, or we have to go through a distributor and like a middleman to make that happen, we tell that person like, hey, here's what you're paying for the bottle of wine. when they go to mark it up and resell it, right, to you, the consumer, or to that restaurant or retail shop, we don't have any control. Legally, we don't have any legal recourse or control over what that pricing is. We cannot do it. We can give them suggested pricing. That's why you have the term and acronym SRP, suggested retail price, right? And that is what we provide. And now, I don't want this to be like a big kerfuffle with anyone who distributes or sells wine, because the overwhelming majority of places will try and hold true to like what your retail pricing is. You can tell them like, hey, this is kind of one of our smaller productions. You know, we're a small brand. Like, this is kind of the floor of where we see this get priced normally. If you could try and keep it above that, that would be great. We can kind of politely suggest like, this is the retail price. Please work within the confines of this. But there are plenty of times where maybe a wine's not moving all that well, a distributor's long on inventory, or a restaurant's long on inventory, and they want to switch over to something else, or they're just trying to clear out space, that they'll start discounting things. You know, in the case of Costco, you know, between them and Total Wine, they're the two biggest retailers of alcohol in the country, wine in particular, right? So they can kind of not do whatever they want, but also Costco is a wholesale place. It's like, hey, we're selling volume. Our margins suck, but we're selling so much that we're making a boatload of money regardless. So you can find really high-end wines. I mean, you've seen everything from like Contessa in there. You know, I mean, Camus you can find in Walgreens now, but like you could find back in the day when they were much smaller, you could find like their Special Select and like other stuff in Costco. And a lot of times you'd be able to buy it for cheaper than, you know, there at Costco than you would at like at their place, like at the winery in Rutherford. Or wait, yeah, Rutherford. For some reason, I had Oakville in my mind. I'm like, nope, that's Silver Oak. Don't confuse the Cabernet dynasties in the valley. Don't be that guy. You've been here for your whole life. Sheesh. So, you know, if a retailer or a restaurant starts discounting your wine, frankly, there's nothing you can do about it except not sell them wine again. So, if it so happens that you're working with a distributor and you get like that phone call, and we've had this phone call happen when we used to distribute a lot more of our wines, where someone would be like, hey, like I'm in your wine club. I bought your Merlot. And at the time, this was probably like 2015, maybe 2016. So quite a few years ago. I think our Merlot was $60 at the time. And someone found it in a retail shop, I think up in Oregon, for like 48 or like $50. Like it was a solid like 20% off or so, like roughly give or take or whatever. And they're like, why am I seeing it for so much cheaper up here? Like you should be giving your wine club members the best deal. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but at the same time, you have to have this kind of conversation of like, number one, I can't control that pricing. And I'm going to be calling them and be like, hey, calling my rep up there and be like, hey, by the way, if this is what they're going to do to us and they're going to discount our product heavily, like, please don't sell to that account anymore. Like, we can cut off the supply. We can't necessarily tell them how to price the wine, but we can tell our sales representatives and distributors to be like, we're no longer working with this account. Do not sell them any more wine. So we can do that. Number two is that, and this is kind of the perk of buying direct from the winery, is that yes, it can be more expensive and sometimes is. However, you know that when you buy direct from the winery, whether it's through the wine club, through their mailing list, you know, whatever the case may be, you're at the winery itself, you know, you can know that that wine is being shipped to you by the winery. It's been in possession of one person. It didn't sit outside on a loading dock on a super hot day or a super cold day. It hasn't changed hands multiple times. Like, we don't have any control over the trucking or what happens to it. Like, logistically, we just can't do it. It's like shipping something through UPS or FedEx. Like, once it's out of your hands, you just have to hope that they get the job done. And if they screw up, you know, you have to, you're just playing cleanup at that point, which sucks, right? We have no control over the common carriers for anything, much less wine. So, you know, you hope that going through the winery, it limits the amount of hands kind of touching the wine. You know that it's been stored appropriately and that, you know, you're going to be getting a quality product. Not only that, if you're buying it from the winery, you're on that mailing list or in that wine club, you know you're going to have access to that wine regularly, where you might see this one time in a retail shop or one time in a Costco and never see it again. So, you know, you might get that. And this is what I would sell to people. It's like, if you're comfortable buying it from this retail shop in Oregon, you know, all these years ago, I'm like, go, that's a great deal. They're never going to have there. It's very unlikely. And I just kind of hint, I'm like, it's very unlikely that they're going to have that wine again at that price. So I hope you get it while you can. And then, you know, when you're ready to buy more from us, you can buy it from us directly, or maybe find another shop that carries it. And that's exactly what happened, is they could no longer find it up. I'm like, oh, I guess you have to buy it through us now. That's so crazy that they stopped offering that wine. Weird how that works. So, you know, keep in mind that when you're selling wine to a retail shop or like through a distributor, typically you're discounting your wine at half off, right? So your margins officially suck, and they have to mark it up to get their cut, and then they sell it to the retail shop or restaurant, and then they mark it up to get their cut. You know, it's a scam, kind of, you know, but that's how it works. So, you know, if a place like Costco wants to work on really slim margins and sell just a lot of volume, they can do that. If it's a wine shop that does high volume or a restaurant that does high volume, they can mark stuff down and sell it for a great price and just crush it in terms of just the overall burn rate of volume that they're going through. So my suggestion is, when you see something like this and it's a wine that you know you like, fucking buy it up, have at it. Just know that it might be very, very fleeting. You might never see that again. And there is a chance that because of the number of hands that are involved in getting that wine to that place, there is could be more bottle variability there. It's rare, but it is a possibility. So it's why folks like us who ship directly to people more often than not, or, you know, people buy from us directly more often than not, it's why, you know, we try and it's the reason why we do it, is we can typically maintain more quality. And if we happen to be working with a distributor, then they're people that we've vetted, they're people we know, they've become friends or good colleagues, and they're people that we trust to do right by us. But this is a super common thing. You can find wines much cheaper out and about and in the wild, far more affordable than sometimes at the winery. It just depends on that retail shop and kind of their business model and what they want their margins to be. You know, for a lot of big producers, a lot of times it doesn't matter. It's like, hey, we're just trying to sell as many boxes of wine, as many cases as we can, push volume. We're just trying to make as much volume as we can. You know, it doesn't matter. We're just trying to hold on to this account, just keep them happy, and we don't have to worry about it. For smaller people like us, this can be a big issue, and it's something that we, you know, as we've kind of talked about here today, there are ways to kind of work with that, around it, through it, over it, under it, so on, so forth. All right. That was one of my favorite interview questions, actually. I was interviewing for a pretty high-end place. This would have been, shoot, like in 2014. It was a job that actually was way over my head, but I had this was kind of like my answer to that question, because the gentleman who asked me, it was like, hey, this customer found this, they're in our wine club, they pay top dollar for this wine, they found it discounted in this retail shop, how do you deal with that from a customer service standpoint? And it was basically everything I just said. It was one of my favorite questions to answer, because I feel like I nailed it. All righty, question number four. This is, if I had a crystal ball, I'd be rolling it after this question. Do you think Napa Cabernet Sauvignon will ever decline in popularity? It seems like there really isn't much variety coming from Napa these days. Oh, this is right up my alley, because frankly, I couldn't agree more. Now, let's be real here. There's a lot of grapes planted in Napa other than Cabernet, but the overwhelming majority of them are in super small volumes. And the wineries that kind of have that diversity in their portfolio only make a little bit of those wines. Cabernet Sauvignon is definitely the king grape. I did peruse these questions before recording today, and in the description of this video, you can find a link to a press document from the Napa Valley Vintners. This is like the Napa Valley fact sheet. So anything kind of numbers related, this will be a great way to kind of like reference some of what I'm talking about, not just in this episode, but in past episodes as well. So to put this conversation of this question like into perspective, you know, Napa Valley is a small area as it stands. It maybe makes up like 4% of California's wine production. It's very, very small. But on top of that, you have, I mean, to like put that in perspective, the valley is like 5 miles wide by like 30 miles long. It's 150 square miles. It's less than 150 square miles. It's a very small area. And I think it's something like 9-ish, maybe 11-ish percent of Napa's like actually planted to grapes. So it's a very small region. That being said, Cabernet Sauvignon takes on the overwhelming majority of that. In fact, it's somewhere to the tune of like 50 plus percent of the grapes that are planted in Napa. The next closest thing, the next closest wine grape to Cabernet Sauvignon is Chardonnay. And that makes up maybe 13-ish percent. Again, this is all coming from this fact sheet. So you can read this, these stats for yourself. So there's a crazy drop-off. You know, Cabernet Sauvignon is estimated to be somewhere around like 24,000 acres planted. Chardonnay is about 5,800, 5,900 acres. And then it just drops from there. You have Merlot is number three. Pinot Noir is number four. Sauvignon Blanc is number five. And then outside of that, everything else like gets cut in half or into a third of that. It's crazy. And I think this is truly one of my pet peeves about Napa and kind of where it's gone is that it got so hyper-focused on Cabernet Sauvignon in particular that there's a lot of it out there right now, and there's a lot of people having a hard time selling some of this wine because it's been very expensive to make. The prices have gone nowhere but up. There's a glut of it available right now, and people are in a bind. When you have like these slower tourism years, when it's slower in wine sales and distribution for some people, this is what you start to butt up against. It's like, hey, we have all this Cabernet to sell, and salespeople are like, great, no one wants Cabernet, so what else you got? And then it obviously just because there's not a lot of other stuff being made because so much of the Napa market is dominated by Cabernet, it can put people into a bind. I honestly don't think that Cabernet is going to go away. I really don't, because there's, you know, going back to just the size of Napa, there's actually in the world of wine, there's a very small amount of Napa Cabernet made in, you know, relation to wines of California and wines of the US and of course wines of the world. It is a very small place all said and done. So is Cabernet just going to like fall off this cliff and decline in popularity precipitously like Merlot did in the 2000s? I don't know. Maybe. This is where I wish I had a crystal ball, because if it was going to, I would switch to something immediately. I mean, honestly, this is why we started with Merlot and Riesling and Pinot Noir in our program, is like, let's do something different. There are all these people jumping on the Cabernet bandwagon, and now there's a lot of people with a lot of Cabernet to sell and not a lot of outlets for it. So I'm not going to say we're at like this crazy tipping point or anything right now, but I think this is kind of, you know, this was kind of like the damned if you do, damned if you don't. Like Napa Cabernet got so popular and people were making so much money. It was like, we have to be in the Cabernet game. So many people jumped on that bandwagon, because if you didn't, you just got, you know, elbow, you just got boxed out of that marketplace, you know? And, you know, if you did do it, it's like, well, now we have all this Cabernet and we're known for this, but it's a tough sell right now. What do we do? It's time to start being creative. So I don't think Napa Cab's going to necessarily decline in popularity. I do think it's going to have a little bit of a reckoning between, you know, pricing and availability. And hopefully we see the Napa, like, just agriculture kind of get a little bit more variety. It's kind of a shame that this is such an amazing growing area and so much is dominated by a single variety. It makes me kind of sad, to be honest. Because it's not just the Bordeaux varieties that grow well here. There's a lot of cool stuff that could be done in and around the vineyards of Napa. And it just so happens that, you know, Cabernet Sauvignon is the cash cow. So everyone jumped on board. A lot of cool older plantings got ripped out in favor of Cabernet Sauvignon, or Chardonnay for that matter. And there's not as much variety as personally I think there should be. I'm hoping that kind of evens itself out. But again, if I had a crystal ball, man, we would all be filthy rich, right? It'd be like getting the sports almanac and Back to the Future. We'd just be like, let's make a killing. Let's do this. All right. I think we got time for one more. Let's sneak in one more question here. Oop. As long as I type in the right timestamps, so I don't have to go searching for it later. Question number 5. Oh, and this actually kind of ties into something I mentioned in that last question. And it starts with, you've mentioned in past episodes that it has been a slower tourism year in Napa. How's that affecting wineries? Are they finding success elsewhere? It's affecting wineries in a huge way. At least some wineries, you know. I'll give you like our own like personal anecdote from it is that the year was off to basically a pretty average start. Like we were on par with what we did the year prior in 2023. And then there was kind of this gut punch in May and into June where it was like all of a sudden we went from being like relatively flat to like, oh shit, we're 10% down. And I think that seems to be the case for a lot of people where there was kind of like this drop off. But even now, in like the month of July, like we've surpassed last year's numbers in July, not in terms of tourism, but in terms of sales. And then in August, it's already projected to surpass last year. So there's like this, it's kind of this weird rocky sea right now. And it is affecting wineries greatly. I mean, for us, you know, in particular, like we're actively deciding to make less wine this year so that we have less grape bills to pay. Like it's just kind of what we have to do. I wish that wasn't the case, but it is just kind of where we're at. We're being very, very fiscally conservative right now because we're hoping that it becomes a little bit more affordable for people to come back to California, to come back to Napa. I mean, the hotels, as many of you are probably aware, if you've been to Napa at any time recently, is that hotel prices are just outrageous. You know, they learned through COVID that they can operate at 20 or 30% occupancy and just jack up the price of the room 3 to 5 times and still make the same amount of money. It sucks. And it forces people like you to pay arm and a leg for a shitty hotel, you know, versus, you know, an auberge resort, which is like more than $1,200 a night. You're like, sheesh, like it's either, you know, $600 or $800 a night for like a regular, you know, hotel chain. And then, you know, these crazy ones are all well over $1,000 a night. And, you know, hey, listen, if you want to sling that much money for a hotel or resort, no harm, no foul. But that's not everybody. There are a lot of wine drinkers out there. Fuck, I can't afford $600 a night in a hotel. You know, there's no way. There's no way. So, you know, I'm trying to, you know, score hotel rooms for like a third of that, you know, when I'm traveling. So, you know, for those that are want to spend more money on wine and less on accommodations, like I get it 100%. So, you know, there's a confluence of factors. We've talked about, you know, flights and how expensive it is. There's been multiple occasions over the last like year and a half where if you've been in Denver or East, it's been cheaper to fly to Europe than it has been to come to California, which is bonkers. You combine that with, you know, the cost of the stays. And I do think, frankly, that tasting fees and like minimum purchases at wineries have bitten a lot of people in a bad way. It's something that, unfortunately, people are kind of like buckling down and saying, hey, we want to see less people, but they need to spend more. And now they're seeing a lot less people. And it's like, uh-oh, what do we do now? Again, this is all kind of like anecdotal stuff. But a lot of wineries are affected. A lot of them are like us and seeing a downturn in business this year. And we're trying to like figure it out. Some of us are finding success elsewhere. This is a year where we have now distributed more wine than we have since about 2016. It's been a very solid like seven, eight years since we've done this much work, working with distribution around the country, specifically in Missouri and in Texas, and trying to open up, you know, other places around the country as well. And that's kind of been what's floated us. It's still tough because, you know, as I mentioned about, you know, in the like wine shop and like distribution pricing and all that, like our margins basically cut down to almost nothing. It's still money in the bank is money in the bank because we're covering the cost of that wine that we had made, as well as maybe the travel to go out there and work with these distributors and help sell these wines. And hopefully there's a little bit of, you know, profit on top of that we can use to pay some of our bills. But that dollar doesn't go nearly as far as selling a wine directly to our wine club, or on our mailing list or wherever the case may be. So We are finding success there, albeit it is limited because of just the volume you have to do in order to make it really make financial sense. A lot more wineries are going on the road. In fact, some of you listening to this have seen us out on the road for bigger kind of collective events or doing private events with you in your own, you know, home city. We do that kind of stuff all the time. And it is something that has been very, very popular and gotten more popular since about 2016, 17, when we saw the last little kind of like downturn in business around Napa. That's why I started traveling a whole bunch for our wine business. It's why many of us actually, I was barely home this spring. From the end of March through basically the beginning of June, I think I was home for maybe one and a half, like full week, like a not in like spread out. It's like a day here, 2 days here, 3 days there. You know, it might have been a week and a half total across, you know, that stretch. It was a lot of travel and it was a lot of nights spent, you know, in a city for one night, then jumping on a plane, flying to the next one, then flying to the next one, the next one. And some success can be had there. But it's still challenging. It is still challenging for us to kind of get through these rocky years. But very typically, if you, it's not like you can see this coming necessarily, but if you have a good, you know, contingency plan to get through rough years like this, like we do, and it's tight, but we're figuring it out, then you'll be all right. You know, typically these bounce back. And also it's an election year, so things are crazy anyway economically, right? It just, it's the way these normally shake down. Typically election years are rough years economically. It's just how it goes. And this one's, you know, pretty exceptional. But what are you going to do? So, I mean, realistically, if you're worried about the Napa wine industry and the wineries that you love to support, now's a great time to buy some wine and support them. It's a kind of an ongoing conversation for those of us in the wine industry in the U.S. is kind of the butting of heads that we have with like imports and wines coming from outside of the country. Like you go to towns in France or Italy, like you're not drinking wines that come from outside of that area. It is hyper-focused. It is hyper-local. Like, this is the wine we make here. There might be a few other things on the list that we know we can sell to tourists or, you know, certain people that are into this kind of stuff. But for the most part, it's like, this is what we do here. This is what you're going to have to buy. And it's just not like that in the U.S. It's always so surprising, like the amount of restaurants in Napa that don't have a majority of Napa wines on their wine list. Hell, for that matter, any restaurant in the country. Like, there are amazing wine industries all over this US of A, and the amount of restaurants that focus on European wines or South African wines or Australian wine, whatever, like, there's just, it kind of hurts our heart a little bit at times, because it's like, hey, we're doing good stuff too. Like, you can't support local, what the hell? You know, so that can be a little frustrating. But again, we will persevere. This has been a slower year for a lot of people, including ourselves. But we're doing our best to not go anywhere and be here for you guys as the years go on. Shoot, we've been making wine for 15 years already. I'm planning on doing this for at least another 15. That's my plan. All right, I think that'll just about do. We're up against the time limit here. I try and keep these around like 40, 45 minutes or so. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Thank you for those that submitted questions. Just a reminder to do so. You can slide into our DMs on any of our social networks at MTGA Wines. That's on YouTube, Instagram, The Book of Face, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. You can also head to our website, mtgawines.com, where you can scroll down to the bottom. Again, there's that little dialogue box where you can submit questions. You can also find out more about us, our wines, who we are, all that good stuff while you're there as well. And sign up for the newsletter while you're at it. Thank you so much for listening, for downloading, for subscribing. Please continue to share, like, and rate, review the podcast. We've seen a nice little bump in overall followers and downloads and everything. And it's all because of you guys kind of supporting what we do. I'm excited to continue this in the future. We have some amazing shows coming up for you talking about the 2022 blending session and the challenges therein, as well as diving right back into wine additives. So those will be coming out in the next few weeks. Have an amazing rest of your day, week, weekend, and we'll see you next time on the Wind Up Podcast. Cheers.